7. Thinking the Unthinkable. What if the third Jewish Commonwealth meets the fate of the first two? The scenario is not that far-fetched. A Palestinian state is born, arms itself, concludes alliances with, say, Iraq and Syria. War breaks out between Palestine and Israel, over borders or water or terrorism. Syria and Iraq attack from without. Egypt and Saudi Arabia join the battle. The home front comes under guerrilla attack from Palestine. Chemical and biological weapons rain down from Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Israel is overrun. Why is this the end? Can the Jewish people not survive as they did when their homeland was destroyed and their political independence extinguished twice before? Why not a new exile, a new diaspora, a new cycle of Jewish history? First, because the cultural conditions of exile would be vastly different. The first exiles occurred at a time when identity was nearly coterminous with religion. An expulsion 2 millennia later into a secularized world affords no footing for a reestablished Jewish identity. But more important, why retain such an identity? Beyond the dislocation would be the sheer demoralization. Such an event would simply break the spirit. No people could survive it, not even the Jews. This is a people that miraculously survived 2 previous destructions and 2 millennia of persecution in the hope of ultimate return and restoration. Israel is that hope. To see it destroyed, to have Isaiah's and Jeremiah's lamenting the widows of Zion once again amid the ruins of Jerusalem is more than one people could bear. Particularly coming after the Holocaust, the worst calamity in Jewish history. To have survived it is miracle enough. Then to survive the destruction of that which arose to redeem it, the new Jewish state, is to attribute to Jewish nationhood and survival supernatural power. Some Jews and some scattered communities would, of course, survive. The most devout, already a minority, would carry on, as an exotic tribe, a picturesque, Amish-like anachronism, a dispersed and pitied remnant of a remnant. But the Jews as a people would have retired from history. We assume that Jewish history is cyclical. Babylonian exile in 586 BC, followed by return in 538 BC. Roman exile in AD 135, followed by return, somewhat delayed, in 1948. We forget a linear part of Jewish history. There was one other destruction, a century and a half before the fall of the First Temple. It went unrepaired. In 722 BC, the Assyrians conquered the other, larger Jewish state, the Northern Kingdom of Israel. Judah, from which modern Jews are descended, was the Southern Kingdom. This is the Israel of the 10 tribes, exiled and lost forever. So enduring is their mystery that when Lewis and Clark set off on their expedition, one of the many questions prepared for them by Dr. Benjamin Rush at Jefferson's behest was this. What affinity between their, the Indians, religious ceremonies and those of the Jews? Jefferson and Lewis had talked at length about these tribes, explains Stephen Ambrose. They speculated that the lost tribes of Israel could be out there on the plains. Alas, not. The 10 tribes had melted away into history. As such, they represent the historical norm. Every other people so conquered and exiled has in time disappeared. Only the Jews defied the norm. Twice. But never, I fear, again. The Weekly Standard, May 11th, 1998. Chapter 13. The Golden Age. The 80s. Revival. Rarely does history respect the calendar, but this time, events have conspired to demarcate precisely the 1980s. Christmas, 1979, the day of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, marks the apogee of the Soviet Empire. November of 1989, with the communist crack-up in Eastern Europe, marks its nadir. What happened in the interval defines the 80s. They will be remembered long after the avarice, the corruption, and the other delightful excesses of the time are forgotten, as the decade of the revival and triumph of the West. 1979 was the annus mirabilis of the Soviet Imperium. In that one year, Iran turned fanatically anti-American, and the Soviets, or their clients, seized Afghanistan, Nicaragua, Cambodia, and, just to rub it in, Grenada. It was also the West's post-war low, as oil shocks, inflation, and the hostage crisis completed America's post-Vietnam demoralization. Then the Great Turn, which came not with Reagan's inaugural, but in the interest of historical neatness, in 1980, the last year of the Carter administration. It was a post-Afghanistan Jimmy Carter who reasserted a foreign policy hard line, arming the Mujahideen, embargoing Soviet grain, cutting off aid to the Sandinistas. It was then, too, that Carter's Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker began squeezing the economy to break inflation. Reagan finished the job with a vengeance. He let Volcker's cruel but inflation-breaking recession proceed through the 1982 election year. He challenged the Soviets to an all-out arms race with which they could not keep up. He brandished SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, which the Soviets read as a sign that the United States was prepared to use its technological superiority to trump Soviet military power, their one claim to superpower status. NATO then held together for the most overlooked geopolitical victory of the 80s, the successful deployment of the intermediate-range nuclear missiles, INF, in Europe, thus facing down both Soviet threats and the West's peace movement. The final straw was the Reagan Doctrine, which put American arms and money behind a worldwide anti-communist guerrilla campaign that gave the Soviets bleeding wounds on three continents. And just when they thought they had America down, the combination of INF, SDI, the Reagan Doctrine, and the huge defense buildup made it clear to the Soviets that they were facing a future that they could only lose. American resilience in this decade came as a shock to the Soviets. Their new foreign policy is the residue of that shock. After all, the Soviets had achieved something astonishing. For 40 years, they had single-handedly taken on the most formidable alliance of great powers in history, the United States, Britain, France, Japan, two-thirds of Germany, and a host of other highly industrialized countries, and held it to a draw. At the end of the 80s, it became clear to Gorbachev that this could not continue. In July of 1988, Eduard Shevardnadze, before his own foreign ministry workers, scornfully rejected the idea, which gained a firm hold in the minds and deeds of certain strategists, that the Soviet Union could be as strong as any possible coalition of states opposing it. Their only hope was to abandon a losing contest. They sued for peace. Who killed communism? There is a lot of credit to go around, but certainly none goes to those who, since 1972, have urged, "Come home, America," who opposed the defense buildup, who inflamed the nuclear hysteria of the early 80s and joined its panicked, now merely quaint, call for a nuclear freeze, who called for a moratorium on INF, that is, a surrender to the street, who denounced the Reagan Doctrine on the grounds that it was the road to Vietnam, when in fact it turned Brezhnev's empire into a Soviet Vietnam. Wrong on every count. Now, foreign policy liberals are reduced to arguing that the monumental collapse of the Soviet empire is the work of one man whose rise is some complicated accident of Russian history. The Gorbachev reversal is no accident. It was the premise and the goal of the entire policy of containment, as outlined by George Kennan in 1947. It would be an exaggeration to say that American behavior, unassisted and alone, could bring about the early fall of Soviet power in Russia, he wrote. But the United States has it in its power to increase enormously the strains under which Soviet policy must operate, and in this way to promote tendencies which must eventually find their outlet in either the breakup or the gradual mellowing of Soviet power. The 80s represent the final fulfillment of that policy. Which is why, with the waning of the decade, the conservatives' time might soon be up. Voters are not sentimental. They don't get points for past achievement. They turned out Winston Churchill less than 3 months after VE Day. The rule is, what have you done for me lately? After the Democratic Party built the magnificent structure of the New Deal, it ran out of ideas, and the voters threw the rascals out. Conservatives have done what they were asked to do in 1980, break inflation and restore Western power. Their job is done. The voters sense it. The Republicans took a whipping in the 1989 elections. Their social agenda, most prominently abortion, proved unenactable. And that was the fallback for a party whose economic and foreign policy agenda has already been enacted. There is another turn ahead. Democrats will do everything in their power to blow it. But one new idea, and the 90s belongs to them. The Washington Post, November 24, 1989. The 90s. Serenity. What does it mean when the major item in the president's end-of-year news conference is a puppy naming? It means we should be wistful at the passing of 1997. We may never see another year like it. When a chocolate lab leads the news, we know times are good. How good? Look at the numbers. Unemployment is at its lowest in two decades. Inflation hovers at 2%, early 1960s numbers. That is not supposed to happen. We have been bred on the axiom that unemployment and inflation are mutually contradictory, that when one form of social misery declines, the other must rise. Well, not anymore. The economy is growing at more than 3%. Hourly wages are up 4%. Factories are producing at that perfect knife edge of near capacity, but not quite so much as to create industrial bottlenecks, and thus shortages and inflation. Even more amazing are the indices of social pathology, which we once assumed must inexorably get worse. They have reversed course. Crime is down dramatically. Rape, for example, is down 45% since 1993. Murder, about 30%. In New York City, the crime rate has not been this low in 30 years. The unlivable has become livable again. Welfare rolls are down, too. After just 12 months of welfare reform, August 1996 to July 1997, one in every six welfare recipients has gone off the dole. That is almost 2 million people. In places with aggressive anti-welfare programs, such as Wisconsin, rolls have been cut by a third. Even such recalcitrant indices as abortion are down. Nor are the good times just economic and social. Geopolitically, we are enjoying the fruits of victory in the Cold War. At no time in the past 500 years has the gap in power between the number one nation and its nearest rival been as great as it is today. While the critics had conceded America's military and cultural hegemony, a carrier in every ocean, a Big Mac in every pot, they had long clung to the idea of American economic decline. And look what happened. We are now riding a productivity and growth spurt that has left the rest of the world in our dust. Europe lives with double-digit unemployment and almost total economic stagnation. Asia, the rising tiger, is now in the throes of a collapse so great that its ripples, ironically, constitute the one major threat to our current prosperity. Now, the puzzle. If this is a golden age, why doesn't it feel like a golden age? I recently told an assembly at my son's high school that they were living through a time so blessed they would tell their grandchildren about it. They looked at me uncomprehendingly. First, because they have known little else but good times, and second, because it is hard for anyone to apprehend the sheer felicity of one's own time until it is gone. But I suspect there is a third reason. We live in gold, but without glory. We associate golden ages with heroic times like that of Pericles. Our triumphs, in contrast, are of the domestic variety. This is the age of Seinfeld, life in miniature. No great battles, no great art, no great triumphs. We know these are diminished times when our most recent military hero is a pilot who, shot down by ragtag Serbs, manages to survive by hiding in the forests of Bosnia like a scared little bunny rabbit. His words, Scott O'Grady's heroism is his honesty. No matter, who needs wars? Who needs heroes? Who needs glory? These things are not sought, they are thrust upon a nation, unwillingly. Britain's finest hour was 1940. Would you choose for your child to live in London during the Blitz or in Lansing under Clinton? By any historical standard, life has never been so good. Why, the news has gotten so absurdly good, we have to cast our net very far to find the bad. El Nino is about the best we can do. Does this mean that the news will only get better? On the contrary, with each passing month of such profound tranquility and prosperity, the implausibility of these times becomes all the more striking. Golden ages never last. There might be a sudden crisis, perhaps a collapse of economic confidence coming from the Asian contagion, or perhaps just a gradual undoing of all the self-reinforcing good news. A spike of inflation, a little recession, a rise in welfare, and the whole cycle slowly reverses itself. I hold with those who say this lovely world will end in ice, not fire. But either way, it must surely end. So enjoy it while it lasts, because it won't. The Washington Post, December 19, 1997. Cold War Nostalgia. We look back to that era now, and we long for a... I even made a crack the other day. I said, gosh, I miss the Cold War. It was a joke. I mean, I don't really miss it, but you get the joke. President Bill Clinton, interview with the Washington Post, October 15, 1993. It is not really a joke. It is an alibi. When the Clinton administration runs into trouble abroad, debacle in Somalia, humiliation in Haiti, dithering over Bosnia, it likes to preface its list of extenuations with, of course we no longer have the easy divisions of the Cold War to make things clear and crisp and simple. Things are so much harder now. So clear and crisp and simple? Curious. During the Cold War, especially during its last two decades, liberals claimed that things were not so simple, that only ideologues and dimwits, Ronald Reagan, for example, insisted on seeing the world through the prism of the Cold War. Now they tell us how clear and clarifying it was. We had an intellectually coherent thing, said Clinton of the Cold War era. The American people knew what the rules were when we did whatever. What about when we did Vietnam? Vietnam, fought under the theory of containment, enunciated first by Harry Truman in 1947, was the quintessential Cold War engagement. It was also the most divisive. At the time, Bill Clinton called it a war I opposed and despised with the depth of feeling I have reserved solely for racism in America. Yet it was prosecuted by two successive administrations. In the 1972 election, the winner by a landslide was Richard Nixon, war president. Same war. Clinton had a clarity of vision about the war no less certain than Nixon's, only diametrically opposed. Vietnam rent the nation because it presented the basic dilemmas of the Cold War period. Was containment the paramount American foreign policy goal? Was it worth the risk of military intervention? Where? At what cost? There were no easy answers. There was certainly none of the unanimity that nostalgics now pretend there was. To hear the blather about Cold War consensus, one would think that the 80s never happened. At every turn, on every issue for which there presumably was one simple, knee-jerk, anti-Soviet answer, the MX, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Grenada, Euro-missile deployment, there was deep division, and practically every time, liberals, so wistful now for the easy choices of yore, made the wrong choice. In the late 70s, for example, the Soviets aggressively deployed medium-range Euro-missiles designed to intimidate and neutralize Western Europe. It was a clear-cut challenge. The correct response was equally clear-cut, a NATO counter-deployment of comparable medium-range missiles. Reagan and Thatcher and Kohl pulled it off, but not without enormous resistance from Western liberals and leftists. In America, the resistance took the form of a nuclear freeze movement that would have frozen Soviet missiles in place and frozen NATO's out. Where were the Democrats on this one? They forced a nuclear freeze resolution through the House of Representatives, 278-149. Their central idea, if one can speak of a hysteria in terms of ideas, was that Reagan was blinded by his Cold War anti-Sovietism. The real enemy, they insisted, was not communism, but the nuclear weapons themselves. Similarly, on the other great Cold War issue, Third World Revolution, the real enemy, the Democrats protested, was not communism, but deprivation. In the great debates over El Salvador and Nicaragua, liberals insisted that to see these conflicts in Cold War East-West terms was again to miss the point. If Central America were not racked with injustices, there would be no revolution, said the Democrats in a 1983 televised address opposing military aid to El Salvador. There would be nothing for the Soviets to exploit. But unless those oppressive conditions change, that region will continue to seethe with revolution, with or without the Soviets. As history has demonstrated, wrong. No one would dare claim that in Central America, poverty and injustice are gone, but the region no longer seethes with revolution. What happened? Injustice did not disappear. The Soviets did, and with them, the sinews and romance of socialist revolution. The evil empire was the enemy. That was the central tenet of American Cold Warriors. Liberals deplored such talk as crude Manichaeism. Now, after 20 years of deriding anti-communists for being blinded by the Soviet threat, they wistfully recall how the Soviet threat brilliantly illuminated the foreign policy landscape, and lament how obscure it all is with the lodestar gone. Ah, the golden age when everything was easy, and we all joined hands in the Cold War battles of Vietnam and Nicaragua and the Euro missiles. Yesterday, Cold Warrior was a liberal epithet. Today, everyone pretends to have been one. My father, who had a Frenchman's appreciation for cynicism, had a term for this kind of after-battle resume revision. Maquis d'après-guerre, resistance fighter, post-war. Time, November 29th, 1993. Chapter 14, The Age of Holy Terror. September 11th, 2001. This is not crime. This is war. One of the reasons there are terrorists out there capable and audacious enough to carry out the deadliest attack on the United States in its history is that, while they have declared war on us, we have in the past responded, with the exception of a few useless cruise missile attacks on empty tents in the desert, by issuing subpoenas. Secretary of State Colin Powell's first reaction to the Day of Infamy was to pledge to bring those responsible to justice. This is exactly wrong. Franklin Roosevelt did not respond to Pearl Harbor by pledging to bring the commander of Japanese naval aviation to justice. He pledged to bring Japan to its knees. You bring criminals to justice. You rain destruction on combatants. This is a fundamental distinction that can no longer be avoided. The bombings of September 11, 2001 must mark a turning point. War was long ago declared on us. Until we declare war in return, we will have thousands of more innocent victims. We no longer have to search for a name for the post-Cold War era. It will henceforth be known as the Age of Terrorism. Organized terror has shown what it can do. Execute the single greatest massacre in American history. Shut down the greatest power on the globe and send its leaders into underground shelters. All this without even resorting to chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons of mass destruction. This is a formidable enemy. To dismiss it as a bunch of cowards perpetrating senseless acts of violence is complacent nonsense. People willing to kill thousands of innocents while they kill themselves are not cowards. They are deadly, vicious warriors and need to be treated as such. Nor are their acts of violence senseless. They have a very specific aim, to avenge alleged historical wrongs and to bring the great American Satan to its knees. Nor is the enemy faceless or mysterious. We do not know for sure who gave the final order, but we know what movement it comes from. The enemy has identified itself in public and openly. Our delicate sensibilities have prevented us from pronouncing its name. Its name is Radical Islam, not Islam as practiced peacefully by millions of the faithful around the world, but a specific fringe political movement dedicated to imposing its fanatical ideology on its own societies and destroying the society of its enemies, the greatest of which is the United States. Israel, too, is an affront to radical Islam, and thus, of course, must be eradicated. But it is the smallest of fish. The heart of the beast, with its military in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Turkey, and the Persian Gulf, with a culture that corrupts Islamic youth, with an economy and technology that dominate the world, is the United States. That is why we were struck so savagely. How do we know? Who else trains cadres of fanatical suicide murderers who go to their deaths joyfully? And the average terrorist does not coordinate four hijackings within 1 hour, nor fly a plane into the tiny silhouette of a single building. For that, you need skilled pilots seeking martyrdom. That is not a large pool to draw from. These are the shock troops of the enemy, and the enemy has many branches. Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Israel, the Osama bin Laden organization headquartered in Afghanistan, and various Arab liberation fronts based in Damascus. And then there are the governments, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Libya among them. Which one was responsible? We will find out soon enough. But when we do, there should be no talk of bringing these people to swift justice, as Karen Hughes dismayingly promised mid-afternoon yesterday. An open act of war demands a military response, not a judicial one. Military response against whom? It is absurd to make war on the individuals who send these people. Terrorists cannot exist in a vacuum. They need a territorial base of sovereign protection. For 30 years, we have avoided this truth. If bin Laden was behind this, then Afghanistan is our enemy. Any country that harbors and protects him is our enemy. We must carry their war to them. We should seriously consider a congressional declaration of war. That convention seems quaint, unused since World War II, but there are two virtues to declaring war. It announces our seriousness both to our people and to the enemy, and it gives us certain rights as belligerents, a blockade, for example. The long peace is over. We sought this war no more than we sought war with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan or Cold War with the Soviet Union. But when war was pressed upon the greatest generation, it rose to the challenge. The question is, will we? The Washington Post, September 12, 2001. When imagination fails. A few men with knives. Why didn't the passengers, numbering in the dozens, just overpower them? Of the four hijacked planes, only one failed to reach its terror destination. Why just one? The question seems unfair, even disrespectful. But its answer illuminates the deepest problem in facing terrorism, failure of the imagination. The passengers' seeming passivity is reminiscent of the Holocaust. We ask with trepidation, how could Jews have allowed themselves to be herded into gas chambers by just a few people carrying machine guns? Because it was inconceivable. 6 decades later, it remains inconceivable that the men carrying the weapons would do what they, in fact, did do. The victims were told these were showers. Who could imagine herding children into gas chambers? In all of human history, no people had ever done that. The victims could not plumb the depths of their enemy's evil. I suspect the same happened to the doomed passengers on the hijacked planes. After all, hijackings have been going on for 40 years. Almost invariably, everybody ends up okay. The hijacker wants to go to Cuba or make a political point or get the world's attention. Never in history had hijackers intentionally turned a passenger plane into a flying bomb, killing everyone aboard, including themselves. Decades of experience teach us that if you simply do what the hijackers say, they'll eventually get tired and give up. That's the rule. But when the rules don't apply, when inconceivably cold-blooded evil is in command, the victims are truly helpless. In the face of unfathomable evil, decent people are psychologically disarmed. What is so striking and so alien to civilized sensibilities about the terrorists of radical Islam is their cult of death. Their rhetoric is soaked in the glory of immolation, immolation of the infidel, and self-immolation of the avenger. Not since the Nazi rallies of the 1930s has the world witnessed such celebration of blood and soil, of killing and dying. What Western TV would feature, as does Palestinian TV, a children's song with the lyric, "How pleasant is the smell of martyrs, the land enriched by the blood pouring out of a fresh body." The most chilling detail of the 1983 Marine Barracks bombing in Beirut is that in his last seconds, the suicide bomber was smiling. Basamat al-Farah, it is called, the smile of joy. Suicide bombers are taught that they are guaranteed immediate admission to paradise, where 72 black-eyed virgins await their pleasure. The West has not known such widespread, murderous perversion of religion since the religious wars of the 17th century. Who could have imagined deliberately flying into a building? The FBI didn't. The FAA didn't. We could hardly believe it as we saw it happening. What hijacked passenger could possibly imagine such a scenario? Why, then, did the passengers on the plane that went down near Pittsburgh decide to resist the hijackers and prevent them from completing their mission? Because they knew. Their relatives had told them by cell phone that the World Trade Center had already been attacked by hijacked planes. They were armed with final awareness of the nature of the evil they faced. So armed, they could act. So armed, they did. Time, September 24, 2001. The borders of Islam are bloody. We've had unintended wars. We've had phony wars. We've had a soccer war Honduras, El Salvador, 1969. But not since the War of Jenkins' Ear, sparked by Spanish mistreatment of British seamen, including one Captain Robert Jenkins, whose display to the House of Commons of his severed ear launched a war on the Spanish nasties in October 1739, have we had anything quite as, well, idiosyncratic as the War of Parsley Point. What else to call the conflict over Perejil, Spanish for parsley? A godforsaken rocky island the size of a soccer field a few hundred yards off the Moroccan coast that technically belongs to Spain and that Morocco seized July 11, 2002, by force. A dozen soldiers, two tents, and a flag. More farce than force. The reaction was something worthy of the mouse that roared. You half expected Peter Sellers, dressed in drag, to be leading the Spanish invasion force to kick the Moroccans out. In fact, Spain sent what, by current end-of-history European standards, was quite an armada. Two frigates, three patrol boats, a helicopter, and a boatload of threats. On Wednesday, Spain cashed in the threats, retaking the island with ridiculous overkill. Warships, special ground forces, helicopters, and combat aircraft. The remaining six Moroccans surrendered. It is hard to take all of this seriously, since it comes on the heels of the accidental British invasion of Spain earlier this year. Royal Marines in Gibraltar went out to practice beach landings, but missed by a couple of miles and stormed a beach in neighboring Spain. They landed on our coast with typical commando tactics, said the mayor of La Linea de la Concepción proudly, but we managed to hold them on the beach. After Morocco's non-accidental invasion of Perejil, everybody got into the act. The European Union declared its full solidarity with Spain. NATO, which could not even use this worthless rock for target practice, weighed in on Spain's side too. The Arab League predictably lined up with its fellow Arabs, declaring Perejil a Moroccan island. Not exactly the guns of August, although the way far-flung allies, who had not even heard of this misbegotten rock till last week, lined up instantly behind one or the other of the aggrieved parties, had an eerie, ghostly echo. Now, Morocco will hardly go to war over Parsley Point. For one thing, Morocco is no match for Spain. For another, the timing of the whole stunt, during the three-day wedding of the Moroccan king, Mohammed VI, turned the invasion into a cheap, if bizarre, wedding present to himself and the nation. Nonetheless, this comedy holds some serious lessons. Europe berates the United States for holding on to primitive notions of sovereignty at a time when the sophisticated Europeans are yielding sovereignty to Brussels, adopting the euro, wallowing in Kyoto, and most recently genuflecting to the newly established International Criminal Court. Yet, here they are, lining up in lockstep to defend Spanish sovereignty over a piece of worthless rock that only dubiously belongs to Spain, by supposed attachment to the other dubiously claimed Spanish enclaves of Ceuta and Melilla, that in turn are little more than colonial anachronisms on the coast of North Africa. This same Europe heaps scorn on the United States for defending an infinitely more serious sovereign claim to democratic legal jurisdiction over its own citizens and soldiers, rather than yielding it to the arbitrariness of the new criminal court. Even more important, however, is that the War of Parsley Point reminds us of the corrosive irredentism for Islamic lands long ago, taken by the sword and then lost to the sword. We forget Islam's astonishing early successes. From a standing start in the early 7th century, it conquered Arabia, North Africa, and Spain within 100 years. Muslims have not forgotten. The later loss of Spain, to say nothing of European colonialism in the Arab world, including what remains of Spanish sovereignty in Morocco, still burns. After all, how did Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's deputy, begin that first post-September 11th celebratory videotape? By invoking the loss of Andalusia, southern Iberia, lost to the Christian infidel the year Columbus sailed the Atlantic. For many in the Islamic world, it happened yesterday. Much of the conflict in the world today, the Philippines, Kashmir, Chechnya, the West Bank, Sudan, Nigeria, and now on this ridiculous little rock in the Mediterranean, represents the Islamic world, once expanding, long contracting, pushing out once again to reclaim its place in the sun. As Samuel Huntington has written, the borders of Islam are bloody. At least in the War of Parsley Point, no one has been killed and no one is likely to be. It will all end with the games being called on account of silliness. The game goes on everywhere else, however, not as farce, but as tragedy. The Washington Post, July 19, 2002. To war or not to war? There are two logically coherent positions one can take on war with Iraq. Hawks favor war on the grounds that Saddam Hussein is reckless, tyrannical, and instinctively aggressive, and that if he comes into possession of nuclear weapons in addition to the weapons of mass destruction he already has, he is likely to use them or share them with terrorists. The threat of mass death on a scale never before seen, residing in the hands of an unstable madman, is intolerable and must be preempted. Doves oppose war on the grounds that the risks exceed the gains. War with Iraq could be very costly, possibly degenerating into urban warfare. It likely would increase the chances of weapons of mass destruction being loosed by a Saddam Hussein facing extinction and with nothing to lose. Moreover, Saddam Hussein has as yet never used these weapons against America and its allies because he is deterred by our overwhelming power. Why disturb the status quo? Deterrence served us well against such monsters as Stalin and Mao. It will serve us just as well in containing a much weaker Saddam Hussein. Preemption is the position of the Bush administration hawks. Deterrence is advanced by a small number of congressional Democratic doves. But, there is a third way. It is the position of Democratic Party elders Al Gore, Ted Kennedy, both of whom delivered impassioned speeches attacking the president's policy, and, as far as can be determined, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. This third way accepts all the premises of the anti-war camp. It gives us all the reasons why war could be catastrophic: chemical or bioweapon attacks, door-to-door fighting in Baghdad, alienating allies, destroying the worldwide coalition of the war on terror, encouraging the recruitment of new terrorists, etc. Moreover, they argue, deterrence works. "I have seen no persuasive evidence," said Kennedy, "that Saddam would not be deterred from attacking U.S. interests by America's overwhelming military superiority." So far, so good. But then these senior Democratic critics, having eviscerated the president's premises, proceed to enthusiastically endorse his conclusion that Saddam Hussein's weapons facilities must be subjected to the most intrusive and far-reaching inspection, and that if he cheats and refuses to cooperate, we must go to war against him. This is utterly incoherent. In principle, a search for genocidal weapons that can be hidden in a basement or even a closet cannot possibly succeed without the full cooperation of the host government. Not a serious person on the planet believes that Saddam Hussein will give it. More important, why are these critics insisting on inspection and disarmament anyway? They have elucidated all the various costs of attempting to disarm Iraq forcibly, and told us that deterrence has worked just fine to keep Saddam Hussein from doing us any harm. If deterrence works, by what logic does Kennedy insist that Saddam Hussein must be disarmed? The enthusiasm of these senior Democrats for inspections is really nothing more than an argument for delay. Yet what advantage is there to delay? The war will be just as costly tomorrow as today. Even assuming that delay gets us a few extra allies, how does that prevent Saddam Hussein from launching his awful weapons or resorting to urban warfare? The virtue of delay is that it gives Democrats political cover. Ever since George McGovern, Democrats have been trying to escape their reputation for being soft, indeed unserious, on foreign policy. The last time Saddam Hussein threatened the peace by invading Kuwait, 7 out of 10 Democrats in Congress voted against authorizing the use of force and in favor of the useless pseudo-solution of sanctions. So this time, the Democrats' leaders make the anti-war argument, but have the political savvy to conclude by running up the flag and sounding the bugle. I happen to believe that the preemption school is correct, that the risks of allowing Saddam Hussein to acquire his weapons will only grow with time. Nonetheless, I can both understand and respect those few Democrats who make the principled argument against war with Iraq on the grounds of deterrence, believing that safety lies in reliance on a proven, if perilous, balance of terror rather than the risky innovation of forcible disarmament by preemption. What is hard both to understand and to respect, however, is the delay school. They tell us that this war will be both terrible and unnecessary, and then come out foursquare in support of starting it later, after Saddam Hussein has refused to play nice with inspectors. They manage to criticize the war and still come out in favor of it. A neat trick, and given the gravity of the issue, an unseemly one. The Washington Post, October 7, 2002. The surge, denied. No one can spend some 10 days visiting the battlefields in Iraq without seeing major progress in every area. If the U.S. provides sustained support to the Iraqi government in security, governance, and development, there is now a very real chance that Iraq will emerge as a secure and stable state. Anthony Cordesman, The Situation in Iraq, A Briefing from the Battlefield, February 13, 2008. This from a man who is a severe critic of the post-war occupation of Iraq and who, as author Peter Wehner points out, is no wide-eyed optimist. In fact, in May 2006, Cordesman had written that no one can argue that the prospects for stability in Iraq are good. Now, however, there is simply no denying the remarkable improvements in Iraq since the surge began a year ago. Unless you're a Democrat. As Joe Lieberman, Independent Connecticut, put it, Democrats have remained emotionally invested in a narrative of defeat and retreat in Iraq. Their Senate leader, Harry Reid, declares the war already lost. Their presidential candidates, eight of them at the time, unanimously opposed the surge. Then the evidence begins trickling in. We get news of the Anbar Awakening, which has now spread to other Sunni areas and Baghdad. The sectarian civil strife that the Democrats insisted was the reason for us to leave dwindles to the point of near disappearance. Much of Baghdad is returning to normal. There are 90,000 neighborhood volunteers, ordinary citizens who act as auxiliary police and vital informants on terrorist activity, starkly symbolizing the insurgency's loss of popular support. Captured letters of al-Qaeda leaders reveal despair as they are driven, mostly by Iraqi Sunnis, their own Arab co-religionists, to flight and into hiding. After agonizing years of searching for the right strategy and the right general, we are winning. How do Democrats react? From Nancy Pelosi to Barack Obama, the talking point is the same. Sure, there is military progress. We could have predicted that. They, in fact, had predicted the opposite, but no matter. But it's all pointless unless you get national reconciliation. National is a way to ignore what is taking place at the local and provincial level, such as Shiite cleric Amar al-Hakim, scion of the family that dominates the largest Shiite party in Iraq, traveling last October to Anbar in an unprecedented gesture of reconciliation with the Sunni sheikhs. Doesn't count, you see. Democrats demand nothing less than federal-level reconciliation, and it has to be expressed in actual legislation. The objection was not only highly legalistic, but also politically convenient. Very few, including me, thought this would be possible under the Maliki government. Then, last week, indeed on the day Cordesman published his report, it happened. Mirabile dictu, the Iraqi parliament approved three very significant pieces of legislation. First, a provincial powers law that turns Iraq into arguably the most federal state in the entire Arab world. The provinces get not only power but also elections by October 1st. U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker has long been calling this the most crucial step to political stability. It will allow, for example, the pro-American Anbar sheikhs to become the legitimate rulers of the province, exercise regional autonomy, and forge official relations with the Shiite-dominated central government. Second, Parliament passed a partial amnesty for prisoners, 80% of whom are Sunni. Finally, it approved a $48 billion national budget that allocates government revenue, about 85% of which is from oil, to the provinces. Kurdistan, for example, gets one-sixth. What will the Democrats say now? They will complain that there is still no oil distribution law. True, but oil revenue is being distributed to the provinces in the national budget. The fact that Parliament could not agree on a permanent formula for the future simply means that it will be allocating oil revenue year by year as part of the budget process. Is that a reason to abandon Iraq to al-Qaeda and Iran? Despite all the progress, military and political, the Democrats remain unwavering in their commitment to withdrawal on an artificial timetable that inherently jeopardizes our very real chance that Iraq will emerge as a secure and stable state. Why? Imagine the transformative effects in the region, and indeed in the entire Muslim world, of achieving a secure and stable Iraq, friendly to the United States and victorious over al-Qaeda. Are the Democrats so intent on denying George Bush retroactive vindication for a war they insist is his that they would deny their own country a now achievable victory? The Washington Post, February 22, 2008. Who lost Iraq? Barack Obama was a principled opponent of the Iraq War from its beginning. But when he became president in January 2009, he was handed a war that was won. The surge had succeeded. Al-Qaeda in Iraq had been routed, driven to humiliating defeat by an Anbar awakening of Sunnis, fighting side by side with the infidel Americans. Even more remarkably, the Shiite militias had been taken down, with U.S. backing, by the forces of Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. They crushed the Sadr militias from Basra to Sadr City. Al-Qaeda decimated. A Shiite prime minister taking a decisively nationalist line. Iraqi Sunnis ready to integrate into a new national government. U.S. casualties at their lowest ebb in the entire war. Elections approaching. Obama was left with but a single task. Negotiate a new status of forces agreement, SOFA, to reinforce these gains and create a strategic partnership with the Arab world's only democracy. He blew it. Negotiations, such as they were, finally collapsed last month. There is no agreement, no partnership. As of December 31st, the U.S. military presence in Iraq will be liquidated. And it's not as if that deadline snuck up on Obama. He had 3 years to prepare for it. Everyone involved, Iraqi and American, knew that the 2008 SOFA calling for full U.S. withdrawal was meant to be renegotiated. And all major parties but one, the Sadr faction, had an interest in some residual stabilizing U.S. force, like the post-war deployments in Japan, Germany, and Korea. 3 years, two abject failures. The first was the administration's inability, at the height of American post-surge power, to broker a centrist nationalist coalition governed by the major blocs. One predominantly Shiite, Malikis, one predominantly Sunni, Ayatollahis, one Kurdish. That among them won a large majority, 69%, of seats in the 2010 election. Vice President Biden was given the job. He failed utterly. The government ended up effectively being run by a narrow sectarian coalition where the balance of power is held by the relatively small, 12%, Iranian client Sadr faction. The second failure was the SOFA itself. U.S. commanders recommended nearly 20,000 troops, considerably fewer than our 28,500 in Korea, 40,000 in Japan, and 54,000 in Germany. The president rejected those proposals, choosing instead a level of 3,000 to 5,000 troops. A deployment so risibly small would have to expend all its energies simply protecting itself. The fate of our tragic, missionless 1982 Lebanon deployment, with no real capability to train the Iraqis, build their U.S.-equipped air force, mediate ethnic disputes, as we have successfully done, for example, between local Arabs and Kurds, operate surveillance and special ops bases, and establish the kind of close military-to-military relations that undergird our strongest alliances. The Obama proposal was an unmistakable signal of unseriousness. It became clear that he simply wanted out, leaving any Iraqi foolish enough to maintain a pro-American orientation exposed to Iranian influence, now unopposed and potentially lethal. Message received. Just this past week, Masoud Barzani, leader of the Kurds, for 2 decades the staunchest of U.S. allies, visited Tehran to bend a knee to both President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. It didn't have to be this way. Our friends did not have to be left out in the cold to seek Iranian protection. 3 years and a one war had given Obama the opportunity to establish a lasting strategic alliance with the Arab world's second most important power. He failed, though he hardly tried very hard. The excuse is Iraqi refusal to grant legal immunity to U.S. forces. But the Bush administration encountered the same problem and overcame it. Obama had little desire to. Indeed, he portrays the evacuation as a success, the fulfillment of a campaign promise. But surely the obligation to defend the security and the interests of the nation supersede personal vindication. Obama opposed the war, but when he became commander-in-chief, a terrible price had already been paid in blood and treasure. His obligation was to make something of that sacrifice, to secure the strategic gains that sacrifice had already achieved. He did not, failing at precisely what this administration so flatters itself for doing so well, diplomacy. After years of allegedly clumsy, brutish force, Obama was to usher in an era of not hard power, not soft power, but smart power, which turns out in Iraq to be no power. Years from now, we will be asking not who lost Iraq, that already is clear, but why? The Washington Post, November 3, 2011. From Freedom Agenda to Freedom Doctrine. Today, everyone and his cousin supports the Freedom Agenda. Of course, yesterday it was just George W. Bush, Tony Blair, and a band of neocons with unusual hypnotic powers who dared challenge the received wisdom of Arab exceptionalism, the notion that Arabs, as opposed to East Asians, Latin Americans, Europeans, and Africans, were uniquely allergic to democracy. Indeed, the left spent the better part of the Bush years excoriating the Freedom Agenda as either fantasy or yet another sordid example of U.S. imperialism. Now it seems everyone, even the left, is enthusiastic for Arab democracy. Fine. Fellow travelers are welcome. But simply being in favor of freedom is not enough. With Egypt in turmoil and in the midst of a perilous transition, we need foreign policy principles to ensure democracy for the long run. No need to reinvent the wheel. We've been through something analogous before. After World War II, Western Europe was newly freed but unstable, in ruin, and in play. The democracy we favored for the continent faced internal and external threats from communist totalitarians. The United States adopted the Truman Doctrine that declared America's intention to defend these newly free nations. This meant not just protecting allies at the periphery, such as Greece and Turkey, from insurgency and external pressure, but supporting democratic elements within Western Europe against powerful and determined domestic communist parties. Powerful they were. The communists were not just the most organized and disciplined. In France, they rose to largest post-war party, in Italy, to second largest. Under the Truman Doctrine, U.S. presidents used every instrument available, including massive assistance, covert and overt, financial and diplomatic, to democratic parties to keep the communists out of power. As the states of the Arab Middle East throw off decades of dictatorship, their democratic future faces a major threat from the new totalitarianism, Islamism. As in Soviet days, the threat is both internal and external. Iran, a mini version of the old Soviet Union, has its own allies and satellites, Syria, Lebanon, and Gaza, and its own Comintern, with agents operating throughout the region to extend Islamist influence and undermine pro-Western secular states. That's precisely why in this revolutionary moment, Iran boasts of an Islamist wave sweeping the Arab world. We need a foreign policy that not only supports freedom in the abstract, but is guided by long-range practical principles to achieve it. A freedom doctrine composed of the following elements. 1. The United States supports democracy throughout the Middle East. It will use its influence to help Democrats everywhere throw off dictatorial rule. 2. Democracy is more than just elections. It requires a free press, the rule of law, the freedom to organize, the establishment of independent political parties, and the peaceful transfer of power. Therefore, the transition to democracy and initial elections must allow time for these institutions, most notably political parties, to establish themselves. 3. The only U.S. interest in the internal governance of these new democracies is to help protect them against totalitarians, foreign and domestic. The recent Hezbollah coup in Lebanon and the Hamas dictatorship in Gaza dramatically demonstrate how anti-democratic elements that achieve power democratically can destroy the very democracy that empowered them. 4. Therefore, just as during the Cold War, the United States helped keep European communist parties out of power, to see them ultimately wither away, it will be U.S. policy to oppose the inclusion of totalitarian parties, the Muslim Brotherhood, or for that matter, communists, in any government, whether provisional or elected, in newly liberated Arab states. We may not have the power to prevent this, so be it. The Brotherhood may today be so relatively strong in Egypt, for example, that a seat at the table is inevitable. But under no circumstances Should a presidential spokesman say, as did Robert Gibbs, that the new order has to include a whole host of important non-secular actors? Why gratuitously legitimize Islamists? Instead, Americans should be urgently supporting secular democratic parties in Egypt and elsewhere with training, resources, and diplomacy. We are, unwillingly again, parties to a long twilight struggle, this time with Islamism, most notably Iran, its proxies and its potential allies, Sunni and Shiite. We should be clear-eyed about our preferred outcome, real democracies governed by committed Democrats, and develop policies to see this through. A freedom doctrine is a freedom agenda given direction by guiding principles. Truman did it. So can we. The Washington Post, February 11, 2011. Language and Leadership. Jen Psaki, blameless State Department spokeswoman, explained that the hasty evacuation of our embassy in Yemen was not an evacuation but a reduction in staff. This proved a problem because the Yemeni government had already announced and denounced the evacuation, the word normal folks use for the panicky ordering of people onto planes headed out of the country. Thus continues the administration's penchant for wordplay, the bending of language to fit a political need. In Janet Napolitano's famous formulation, terror attacks are now man-caused disasters, and the global war on terror is no more. It's now an overseas contingency operation. Nidal Hassan proudly tells a military court that he, a soldier of Allah, killed 13 American soldiers in the name of jihad. But the massacre remains officially classified as an act not of terrorism, but of workplace violence. The U.S. ambassador to Libya and three others are killed in an al-Qaeda-affiliated terror attack, and for days it is waved off as nothing more than a spontaneous demonstration gone bad. After all, famously declared Hillary Clinton, what difference does it make? Well, it makes a difference, first, because truth is a virtue. Second, because if you keep lying to the American people, they may seriously question whether anything you say, for example, about the benign nature of NSA surveillance, is not another self-serving lie. And third, because leading a country through yet another long twilight struggle requires not just honesty, but clarity. This is a president who, to this day, cannot bring himself to identify the enemy as radical Islam. Just Tuesday night, explaining the U.S. embassy closures across the Muslim world, he cited the threat from violent extremism. The word extremism is meaningless. People don't devote themselves to being extreme. Extremism has no content. The extreme of what? In this war, an extreme devotion to the supremacy of a radically fundamentalist vision of Islam and to its murderous quest for dominion over all others. But for President Obama, the word Islamist may not be uttered. Language must be devised to disguise the unpleasantness. Result? The world's first lexicological war. Parry and thrust with linguistic tricks, deliberate misnomers, and ever more transparent euphemisms. Next, armor-piercing onomatopoeias and amphibious synecdoches. This would all be comical and merely peculiar if it didn't reflect a larger, more troubling reality. The confusion of language is a direct result of a confusion of policy, which is served by constant obfuscation. Obama doesn't like this terror war. He particularly dislikes its unfortunate religious coloration, which is why Islamist is banished from his lexicon. But soothing words, soothing speeches in various Muslim capitals, soothing policies, open hand, mutual respect, have yielded nothing. The war remains. Indeed, under his watch, it has spread. And as commander-in-chief, he must defend the nation. He must. But he desperately wants to end the whole struggle. This is no secret wish. In a major address to the National Defense University just 3 months ago, he declared, "This war, like all wars, must end." The plaintive cry of a man hoping that saying so makes it so. The result is visible ambivalence that leads to vacillating policy reeking of incoherence. Obama defends the vast NSA data dragnet because of the terrible continuing threat of terrorism. Yet at the same time, he calls for not just amending, but actually repealing the legal basis for the entire war on terror, the 2001 authorization for use of military force. Well, which is it? If the tide of war is receding, why the giant NSA snooping programs? If Al-Qaeda is on the run, as he incessantly assured the nation throughout 2012, why is America cowering in 19 closed-down embassies and consulates? Why was Boston put on an unprecedented full lockdown after the Marathon bombings? And from Somalia to Afghanistan, why are we raining death by drone on violent extremists? Every target, amazingly, a jihadist. What a coincidence. This incoherence of policy and purpose is why an evacuation from Yemen must be passed off as a reduction in staff, why the Benghazi terror attack must be blamed on some hapless Egyptian-American videographer, why the Fort Hood shooting is nothing but some loony army doctor gone postal. In the end, this isn't about language. It's about leadership. The wordplay is merely cover for uncertain policy, embedded in confusion and ambivalence about the whole enterprise. This is not leading from behind. This is not leading at all. The Washington Post, August 9th, 2013. Chapter 15. The Age to Come. Hyperproliferation. Can we survive it? Like many physicists who worked on the Manhattan Project, Richard Feynman could not get the bomb out of his mind after the war. "I would see people building a bridge," he wrote, "and I thought, they're crazy. They just don't understand. They don't understand. Why are they making new things? It's so useless." Feynman was convinced man had finally invented something that he could not control and that would ultimately destroy him. For 6 decades, we have suppressed that thought and built enough history to believe Feynman's pessimism was unwarranted. After all, soon afterward, the most aggressive world power, Stalin's Soviet Union, acquired the bomb, yet never used it. 7 more countries have acquired it since and never used it either. Even North Korea, which huffs and puffs and threatens every once in a while, dares not use it. Even Kim Jong-il is not suicidal. But that's the point. We are now at the dawn of an era in which an extreme and fanatical religious ideology, undeterred by the usual calculations of prudence and self-preservation, is wielding state power and will soon be wielding nuclear power. We have difficulty understanding the mentality of Iran's newest rulers. Then again, we don't understand the mentality of the men who flew into the World Trade Center, or the mobs in Damascus and Tehran who chant "Death to America" and "Denmark," and embrace the glory and romance of martyrdom. This atavistic love of blood and death, and indeed self-immolation in the name of God, may not be new. Medieval Europe had an abundance of millennial Christian sects, but until now it has never had the means to carry out its apocalyptic ends. That is why Iran's arriving at the threshold of nuclear weaponry is such a signal historical moment. It is not just that its president says crazy things about the Holocaust. It is that he is a fervent believer in the imminent reappearance of the 12th Imam, Shiism's version of the Messiah. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has been reported as saying, in official meetings, that the end of history is only 2 or 3 years away. He reportedly told an associate that on the podium of the General Assembly last September, he felt a halo around him, and for those 27 or 28 minutes, the leaders of the world did not blink, as if a hand was holding them there and opened their eyes to receive his message. He believes that the Islamic Revolution's raison d'etre is to prepare the way for the Messianic redemption, which in his eschatology is preceded by worldwide upheaval and chaos. How better to light the fuse for eternal bliss than with a nuclear flame? Depending on your own beliefs, Ahmadinejad is either mystical or deranged. In either case, he is exceedingly dangerous. And Iran is just the first. With infinitely accelerated exchanges of information helping develop whole new generations of scientists, extremist countries led by similarly extreme men will be in a position to acquire nuclear weaponry. If nothing is done, we face not proliferation, but hyper-proliferation. Not just one, but many radical states will get weapons of mass extinction, and then so will the fanatical and suicidal terrorists, who are their brothers and clients. That will present the world with 2 futures. The first is Feynman's vision of human destruction on a scale never seen. The second, perhaps after 1 or 2 cities are lost with millions killed in a single day, is a radical abolition of liberal democracy as the species tries to maintain itself by reverting to strict authoritarianism, a self-imposed expulsion from the Eden of post-Enlightenment freedom. Can there be a third future? That will depend on whether we succeed in holding proliferation at bay. Iran is the test case. It is the most dangerous political entity on the planet, and yet the world response has been catastrophically slow and reluctant. Years of knowingly useless negotiations followed by hesitant international resolutions have brought us to only the most tentative of steps: referral to a Security Council that lacks unity and resolve. Iran knows this, and therefore, defiantly and openly, resumes its headlong march to nuclear status. If we fail to prevent an Iranian regime run by apocalyptic fanatics from going nuclear, we will have reached a point of no return. It is not just that Iran might be the source of a great conflagration, but that we will have demonstrated to the world that for those similarly inclined, there is no serious impediment. Our planet is 4.5 billion years old, and we've had nukes for exactly 61. No one knows the precise prospects for human extinction, but Feynman was a mathematical genius who knew how to calculate odds. If he were to watch us today about to let loose the agents of extinction, he'd call a halt to all bridge building. Time, March 26, 2006. Death by drone. The nation's vexation over the morality and legality of President Obama's drone war has produced a salutary but hopelessly confused debate. Three categories of questions are being asked. They must be separated to be clearly understood. One, by what right does the president order the killing by drone of enemies abroad? What criteria justify assassination? Answer, A, imminent threat under the doctrine of self-defense, and B, affiliation with Al-Qaeda under the laws of war. Imminent threat is obvious. If we know a freelance jihadist cell in Yemen is actively plotting an attack, we don't have to wait until after the fact. Elementary self-defense justifies attacking first. Al-Qaeda is a different matter. We are in a mutual state of war. Osama bin Laden issued his fatwa declaring war on the United States in 1996. We reciprocated 3 days after 9/11 with Congress's authorization for use of military force against Al-Qaeda and those who harbor and abet it. Such resolutions are the contemporary equivalent of a declaration of war, as evidenced in the 1991 Persian Gulf War and the 2003 Iraq War. Regarding Al-Qaeda, therefore, imminence is not required. Its members are legitimate targets, day or night, awake or asleep, nothing new here. In World War II, we bombed German and Japanese barracks without hesitation. Unfortunately, Obama's Justice Department memos justifying the drone attacks are hopelessly muddled. They imply that the sole justification for drone attack is imminent threat. And whereas Al-Qaeda is plotting all the time, an Al-Qaeda honcho sleeping in his bed is therefore a legitimate target. Nonsense. Slippery nonsense. It gives the impression of an administration making up criteria to fit the president's kill list. No need to confuse categories. A sleeping Anwar al-Awlaki could lawfully be snuffed not because of imminence, but because he was self-declared Al-Qaeda, and thus an enemy combatant, as defined by congressional resolution and the laws of war. 2. But al-Awlaki was no ordinary enemy. He was a U.S. citizen. By what right does the president order the killing by drone of an American? Where's the due process? Answer. Once you take up arms against the United States, you become an enemy combatant, thereby forfeiting the privileges of citizenship and the protections of the Constitution, including due process. You retain only the protection of the laws of war, no more and no less than those of your foreign comrades in arms. Indeed, David French, senior counsel at the American Center for Law and Justice, suggests stripping such traitors of their citizenship, thereby formalizing their extra-constitutional status. Lincoln steadfastly refused to recognize the Confederacy as a separate nation. The soldiers that his Union Army confronted at Antietam were American citizens in rebellion, killed without due process. Nor did the Americans storming German bunkers at Normandy inquire before firing whether there were any German Americans among them. to be excused for gentler treatment while the other Germans were mowed down? 3. Who has the authority to decide life and death targeting? In war, the ultimate authority is always the commander-in-chief and those in the lawful chain of command to whom he has delegated such authority. This looks troubling. Obama sitting alone in the Oval Office deciding which individuals to kill. But how is that different from Lyndon Johnson, sitting in his office choosing bombing targets in North Vietnam? Moreover, we firebombed entire cities in World War II. Who chose? Commanders under the ultimate authority of the president. No judicial review, no outside legislative committee, no secret court, no authority above the president. Okay, you say, but today's war is entirely different. No front line, no end in sight. So what? It's the jihadists who decided to make the world a battlefield and to wage war in perpetuity. Until they abandon the field, what choice do we have but to carry the fight to them? We have our principles and precedents for lawful warmaking and a growing body of case law for the more vexing complexities of the present war. For example, the treatment of suspected terrorists apprehended on U.S. soil. The courts having granted them varying degrees of habeas corpus protection, it is clear that termination by drone, a measure far more severe than detention, would be forbidden, unless Congress and the courts decide otherwise, which, short of a Taliban invasion from New Brunswick, is inconceivable. Now, for those who believe that the war on terror is not war, but law enforcement, A, I concede that they will find the foregoing analysis to be useless, and B, I assert that they are living on a different and distant planet. For us Earthlings, on the other hand, the case for Obama's drone war is strong. Pity that his Justice Department couldn't make it. The Washington Post, February 14, 2013.